This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Amber, somebody should do a follow-up study to try to figure out what Maryland and Delaware, in particular, are doing right.
I do believe you emailed me that study idea this week.
Yes, I am hinting at it yet again, Amber.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me welcoming my co-host, the Olympian of Education Policy, Adam Emerson.
Thank you, Mike. It's good to be back. I've been away for a while.
Yeah, welcome back here in D.C. with your family. That's excellent.
That's correct.
Let me ask you this. If you were an Olympic athlete, which sport would you do?
Probably the decathlon.
The decathlon. Look at you.
Jack of all trades. Jack of all trades, master of none.
I said, so speaking of the Olympics, Adam, have you watched the new Michelle Rhee ad that's been sent around? You're looking at me like you haven't seen
it.
All right. So let me describe it. So this is a takeoff on the Olympics. I guess she showed this during her Meet the Press appearance, national television the other day. And it shows a chubby-looking man doing the ribbon gymnastics event and looking ridiculous. And there's sort of the, you know, watch a fat man dance kind of motif. And then at the end, it's got this, you know, the script is something about this is – this is what would happen if our kids went up in international competition. We're not well prepared. You know, like this guy's not well prepared. And then some statistics about being 17th in the world in math and in science. So a couple of thoughts. First of all, some people have accused Fordham of publishing, Joe, I think the term was sophomoric videos, right? And I got to say, I mean, that there's some truth to that at times, okay? But this one was very sophomoric. And we weren't putting our stuff on national television. Right. So that's point number one. Point number two. What do you think? Is this a fair comparison, this Olympics thing, or is this just overdone?
Probably a little bit overdone.
Yeah. By the way, I don't even know if you know this. 4 years ago, we did a big Education Olympics thing here at Fordham. Throughout the entire Olympics, every day we had this big thing on how poorly we did in international competition. People see these ads and they feel like Michelle Rhee is out there to make the public schools look bad, to make people work in the public schools feel bad, that these international rankings, are really imprecise because they don't take into account things like poverty, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But what do you think? I mean, is this the kind of stuff that gets rank and file Americans, the public, to pay attention to education?
Well, I think it's maybe it's a gimmick. Maybe it's a peg. Maybe it's a way to get people thinking about it more. But as far as firing up the rank and file, probably is not going to.
Yes. All right. Well, I do recommend everybody give it a look and then give me a shout. Let me know what you think. I'm on Twitter at Michael Petrilli. Okay. Lots to cover today. We are going to play Pardon the Gadfly, and then we're going to hear Amber's Research Minute. This is a special school choice edition of the Education Gadfly Show, since Adam is our school choice czar. Of course, our author of our Choice Words blog. And so we're going to talk choice. So Ty, kick it off.
A New York Times analysis found that enrollment declined in nearly half of America's major urban districts over the last 5 years. Is this a sign of charter school success or a concerning trend?
What do you think, Adam? I mean, on the flip side of this is that indeed in many of these cities, charter schools are gaining market share. Mm-hmm. D.C. is going to hit the 50% mark within a couple of years. Other cities aren't that far behind. Those of us that support choice, this is a good thing, right?
It's a good thing. I mean, and I'll credit the Times for actually attributing this decline to a number of factors and not just charter schools. But clearly, charter schools have seen an increase in enrollment. Is this a concerning trend for traditional schools? It probably can't be laid on the doorstep of charter schools. I mean, we do have some evidence that charter schools can have a positive, however modest, competitive effect on traditional schools. And certainly, they can't be largely held blame for this. Is it concerning for traditional schools? Are these districts becoming the districts that no one wants to attend? Whatever factors might contribute for that, I don't think it can be blamed on charter schools.
All right. Well, a couple of thoughts. First of all, what's interesting is that a lot of these cities were still growing back in the 90s when the charter school policies got passed. That's part of the reasons politically why school choice got a foothold, is that at first it wasn't much of a threat. I mean, these schools, a lot of these districts, if anything, had overcrowding issues. They had old, decrepit buildings. So they were happy to have some of these new charter schools take some kids off their hands. Now things have changed, especially in the Midwest and other other parts of industrialized cities where we've got real population declines, people leaving the city for the suburbs or for the Sun Belt. Mm-hmm. On top of that, you've got this encroachment of charter schools, and so suddenly the bottom's falling out on their enrollment, and that means finances. Now, you said these are places no one wants to attend. The big question here is whether these school districts become the place for the schools that the students that nobody else wants to serve, right? So you get to a point where, you know, a huge percentage of the kids who are left in district schools are special needs, are disadvantaged, are extremely poor, huge mobility rates from one school to the other. They get all the tough cases, and therefore these kids are harder to educate than ever before.
Yeah, there's going to be higher concentrations of them certainly over time in traditional schools, and that's going to have a big impact on policy and probably a big impact on the innovations that's left behind in districts if they can muster up the.
I don't necessarily agree that it has to be that way. I mean, I think there are some ways that you can structure incentives to get the choice schools to take those kids to. You know, make sure there's ample funding for kids with special needs, for example. Don't ding the public schools, the charter schools, if they, for example, take kids with mild disabilities, and don't label them as such, right? But if you want to, you know, if you don't want to leave all the toughest kids behind, then create incentives for the choice schools to serve them too.
Yep.
All right, topic number two.
Louisiana unveiled new guidelines for its voucher program on Monday. What did Superintendent John White get right, and where could the program be improved?
Okay, Adam, you wrote about this week.
Well, this is pretty groundbreaking for a voucher program. I mean, more states have made their voucher and tax credit scholarship programs more transparent, to be sure. But no other state is doing what Louisiana is doing, and is using test scores or test performance to help regulate voucher enrollment over time. This is scalable. Obviously, the schools that enroll larger numbers of voucher students are going to be held to this accountability. And that's a good thing. That's something that Fordham is argued for a while right now.
So let's hold on that. So basically the idea here is that there's something of a sliding scale, that schools that just serve a handful of voucher kids are going to keep being treated as private schools.
Exactly.
They won't have, they'll have to test their voucher
kids. They'll still have to take the taste test. Yeah, they'll still have to take the state test.
And report the results.
Exactly.
All right, but they won't be held accountable per se. And accountable means they could get kicked out of the program.
Yeah, it means that the schools can't keep enrolling these kids if their test scores fall flat.
So. All right. So, but for the schools that are serving a lot of these kids, what's the threshold? It's
going to be at least 10 per grade, 40 testable students overall.
All right. Then those schools do have to show that they're serving those kids well if they want to keep participating in the program.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, so this is huge. I mean, this is
very huge.
And then, you know, look, I mean, we have been making this case for a long time that schools that get a significant amount of their money from the public should be held accountable to the public. Now, there's a lot of nuance in how you do that. And some of the debate in Louisiana, as in elsewhere, is do they have to take the same test as the public schools? Is it the same report card as the public schools? And there's all kinds of pros and cons. These are still private schools. Mm-hmm. And even if they've got 40 or 50 kids, it's still a minority of their population.
Exactly.
So these are hard to wrestle with. What's going to be interesting to watch next is to see how many private schools agree to participate under these new conditions. It would be a problem if all of a sudden they say, well, forget about it because there goes your voucher program. I don't think that'll happen.
In fact, they've already got a lot of buy-in from the Catholic schools on this, and that's going to be one of the most single largest sector of schools that would participate in the programs.
Love it. Choice and quality control. See, they can live happily together, hand in hand, like ebony and ivory, Adam. Okay, topic number three.
A California judge sided with parents recently over the validity of signatures gathered for a petition in the Adelanto parent trigger case. Does this mean a parent trigger charter conversion will finally happen?
I mean, because it's great because, you know, we've only been talking about this for like 3 years. There's already like a Hollywood movie about it. I mean, you'd think it would be nice if it actually happened. One little dinky school in the entire country.
Could happen here. May happen here. Probably won't happen before this movie comes out on September 28th. I would be shocked if there hasn't been a court appeal on this. I would be shocked if there isn't another court challenge that drags this on. But we are closer, and there has been no ruling like this from a judge that's come down on the side of parents and on the side of the trigger right now. So this is a positive step for the trigger folks, but I still think they're a long way from making this happen.
I mean, look, I know the cool kids that were supposed to be behind this, that this is, you know, this is the next big thing in school reform, supposedly. I just have a hard time getting excited about it. I mean, partly because it has not happened, right? And the reason it hasn't, I mean, that tells you something, that it may not be a reform that's all that scalable, because it's going to it's easy to challenge in court because it's got all these procedural questions. We don't have a clue what's going to happen next. I mean, no. so you know, yes, you can go to schools. You can organize parents and have the parents say, hey, my school sucks. I'm pissed. I want change. And I think that's healthy, and that's all good. You know, but the then what question is, you know, where we go from here.
Well, I think state legislatures are starting to see this more. They had considered this measure last year, and now it's have seen this slow down quite a bit.
Yeah, but I have to. Don't you think that? I mean, you look at the Wall Street Journal editorial page has been all over this. A lot of the bloggers, a lot of the school reform groups. I mean, there's this sense that let's just chase after the next new thing. I mean, at least in my view, I feel like there's a little bit of that quality to it. You know, instead of keeping focus on some other things that, you know, are still in early days. I mean, let's get the school voucher thing right. Let's get the tax credit thing right. Let's, you know, keep focusing on Common Core implementation. And I mean, it just seems like the next cool thing to fall after. And hey, maybe it'll turn out to be important in a few places. But, you know, the fact that we have been talking about this for so long and we still don't have a place where it's actually led to actual change in a single school, I think it's telling.
I think it's telling, and I still think it should be hard to pull this thing, and that's probably why it will never be scalable to that degree. But in that sense, it's not choice, it's not Common Core, it's not quality control. We have some measures that we can look at in place to keep moving on.
All right, Adam, thanks for joining us. We'll now go on to everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
So, Amber, did you watch that Michelle Rhee video?
I did happen to see it.
Uh-huh. Yes. So what's your take on it?
I can see how it could be a little tad offensive to some folks.
Which demographics are you thinking of?
I mean, like the kids with special needs demographics.
You're saying the guy looked mentally challenged?
He kind of looked like he
challenged?
Was struggling with a special need. Yes, he did.
Among other things. That,
yes.
So, you know what? I have to say, maybe I'm just a little bit sensitive that I feel like Students First is you know, coming in on our territory here. Okay, yes. We were the first ones to bring sophomoric videos
yes.
to the education reform space.
Right.
I don't think we would have produced a video.
We
like
would
that.
Not have been that bad.
No, we wouldn't.
By the way, you know, 4 years ago, Amber and I were stars in our Education Olympics coverage.
We were. I was Dr. Winken Stinken Lagen Stippenstein or something
you were
like
great.
That.
Great. You had been on the job about a week.
A week, and I thought this is my serious like new research director role at Fordham.
Yep. Yeah. And putting that PhD to use. But the other thing was funny was that we went toe-to-toe with Bob Wise at the Alliance for Excellent Education, who had the similar idea. We always thought that we pulled ours off better.
Yes.
Bob Wise, he's back.
Still doing it.
They're going to do it again.
Still doing it, baby. He's just liking the idea, I guess.
So this Olympic comparison just never grows old, Adam. Never grows old. Okay.
Several more weeks.
Do you have any kind of international comparisons for us?
Wow, what a segue. New report from international experts Hanishek, Paul Peterson, and Ludgar Wussmann. Oh, I get that wrong every time. I really wish I knew how to pronounce his name. I think it's Wussmann with like a V. Mike, help me out here.
Yeah,
Mike's not helping me.
Ludgar. Luddy.
Yes.
Luddy W.
Tracks student achievement growth in 49 countries from 1995 to 2009 and also looks at 41 states in the U.S. They use this equating procedure that's been used in other studies to put the various international and national tests on the same common scale. Overall, bottom line, they describe increases in U.S. achievement, U.S. student achievement as middling. 24 countries make larger gains than we do. 24 countries trail us. Over the 14 years analyzed, U.S. students advanced about 22% of a standard deviation, which equates to roughly a year's worth of learning.
It's not bad.
Students in 8 countries, including Hong Kong, Germany, Poland, Colombia, and Lithuania, made gains at twice the rate as American kids. Students in Latvia, Chile, and Brazil, even more than that. As far as state improvement, this is more interesting stuff. Who had the steepest growth trend? What do we think? Mike, you already read this report, didn't you?
Yeah.
He already knows.
It's where we live.
Maryland. Followed by, Adam, where do you live?
Florida.
Florida, Delaware, and Massachusetts. Iowa, Maine, and Oklahoma showed the slowest rates of improvement. And then they kind of try to explain a little bit. They basically say initial student performance explains only about a quarter of the variation among states. Spending increases aren't the reasons for all the gains either, because just as many high-spending states showed relatively small gains as showed large gains. Also, most of the case that the largest gains in average student performance also saw the greatest reductions in students performing below basic. So basically, they're saying it's true that if you lift the average boat, you lift all other boats rather uniformly. Finally, five of the top 10 states with the highest growth were in the South. So they say, huh, maybe it's these education governors in the late 90s in Tennessee, North Carolina, Florida, Texas. Midwestern states made smaller gains.
Mm-hmm. Poor Ohio. So a couple of things here, Amber. First of all, I've always been interested with the international data, looking at change over time. And I've put this to Hanyshek, and I have to say I respect him greatly. I don't think he has a good answer on this one, which is, are we sure that it's the improvements in education that's helping these economies develop, mm-hmm. or is that the economies are getting wealthier and that's leading to higher student achievement?
Yes, and what is his answer?
I think he mumbled. No, I mean, he said that, you know, basically it's impossible to
tell.
It's
right. Impossible, like, how do you, like, dissect, right, and how do you tear that apart, that sort of correlation?
So a country like Brazil or Chile, I mean, these are countries that are, you know, developing at a rapid clip, pulling a lot of people out of poverty every year, so mm-hmm. you're not surprised that their kids mm-hmm. are doing better. And you can say, I mean, it's a chicken and egg thing. It's good that their students are doing better. That's going to help them develop even further. Mm-hmm. That would be my argument. But the Germany example is interesting because here's a country that looks a lot like us, right?
Yep, and that instituted national standards fairly recently. Not that recently, but what year? Do you remember? I remember Bill Schmidt talked about it at our conference a couple years ago.
I think they're maybe 4 years ahead of us.
So that made
But they had a big shock, I think, on PISA in maybe the early 2000s, and mm-hmm. I think they've gotten real motivated since then. It's a federalist system, similar economy, sort of Eastern Europe can be kind of akin to the South here in terms of this, mm-hmm. you know, disparities regionally. But big, huge improvements in Germany. So that's something that I think is harder to write off.
Yeah, that's right. Something I didn't mention, Canada, Australia, and Japan lower than us. So, you know, you just kind of look and say, okay, what are they doing versus what we're doing, mm-hmm. sort of the natural inclination. And we know, you know, I mean, I don't know. I guess Japan's just really kind of been going downhill for a while mm-hmm. now in terms of their economy and now student achievement. So anyway.
Let's talk about the states briefly. So Maryland, how do mm-hmm. we explain Maryland? I mean, do they, in this paper, do they, what do they say? Standards-based reform? Is that what they think?
They don't go too much into that, other than what I mentioned here in terms of yeah. trying to explain. They say, can't put it all on spending increases. You know, can't put it all on where they start at the baseline.
And is it not, how about demographic changes? I mean, can some of these states all of a sudden get less poor or?
Yeah, I mean, they talk a little bit about, you know, you don't see the big changes with the, I think the kids in Texas, when you look at those subpopulations, those kids actually made higher gains than some of the kids mm-hmm. in the other demographic categories. But again, like I said, for the most part, it's you get those average kids up and those other kids are going to come up too. So, mm-hmm.
Well, and also too, these southern states have seen sizable population increases, particularly before the recession hit. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot more families migrating into these states, and these schools are bursting because of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Adam, you know, in Florida, of course, you've lived through a lot of the stuff. You used to cover it as a reporter. Mm-hmm. You know, something right's going on. Jeb Bush says that it's, you know, this comprehensive approach to school reform with standards and testing and choice and digital learning and everything else under the sink, merit pay, you name it. And yet there's still plenty of resistance to reform in Florida.
Plenty of resistance to reform in Florida. Of course, Jeb Bush is no longer the governor there, but clearly still has a lot of influence over these things as he go on. But whatever the resistance might be, it'll probably still be there for a while. But it's good to see the results, and it's good to see a lot of these reforms play out like this.
All right. Well, Amber, somebody should do a follow-up study to try to figure out what Maryland and Delaware, in particular, and Florida and Massachusetts, too, are doing right, mm-hmm. since it seems to be a bit of an untold story.
I do believe you emailed me that study idea this week.
Yes, I am hinting at it yet again, Amber. Oh, maybe we should do it.
Yes, I will process that and get back to you.
Thank you, Amber. All right, that's all the time we've got for this week. Until next week.
I'm Adam Emerson.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show at edexcellence.net. Signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.